And welcome, everyone. I'm Jim Swing. I'm the acting chair for today. And before I start the sign-up sheet for the meetings around, we'll have introductions starting with the Randy Dorn designee.
I'm Glenn Gorton. I am the Director of Student Transportation for the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, and I'm filling in for Randy at this point.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Jeff DeVere, the Deputy Director for the Department of Licensing. Pat is out of town, so I'm here standing in for her.
Okay, thank you.
Jeff Sass, Assistant Chief, Washington State Patrol.
Oh.
Filling for John Batiste.
Okay, thank you.
Roger Millar, Secretary of Transportation. Filling in for myself.
Good morning. I'm Sonny Halden, the new Senior Policy Advisor for Public Safety in the Governor's Policy Office, and the new Sandy Mullins for the Public Safety Assignment.
Darren Rundell, the Director of the Traffic Safety Commission. Thank you all for being here today. I know we've had kind of a snag with some of our commissioners today. With Rosemary Cipolla will be here in just a few minutes, but I think we've got someone coming in. Oh, there we go. Martin, over here. So, thank you for being here.
Jerry Nelson, Traffic Safety Commission.
I'm Mike Gable, Program Manager here at Traffic Safety Commission.
I'm Mark McDowell, I'm Program Manager with Traffic Safety Commission.
Hi, I'm Stacey Hoff, Research Director with the Traffic Safety Commission.
I'm Geneva Hawkins. I'm the FARS Analyst here at the Commission.
Traffic. Shelley Baldwin, Legislative and Media Relations at the Commission.
Jennifer Harris, House Transportation Commission
staff. Good morning. My name is Etika. I am a Program Manager here at Traffic Safety Commission.
Good morning. I'm Greg Fredrickson. I'm a newly appointed Regional Administrator with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration in Seattle. So thank you for the invite today, Darren. Thank you.
Wes Ruffel, Lewis County Sheriff's Office. Rob Stiles, Lewis County Sheriff's Office.
Martin Mueller, Department of Health.
I'm Rosemary Cipolla, and I just drove up from Longview, and it's raining like a son of a bitch, and there was a geezer in a Corvette that was the only accident I saw. He was spun out and going the wrong way on the right side of the freeway. So other than that, I did see the Lewis County Sheriff's on the highway, too. You guys are doing a good job.
Well, they let you through. Huh?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. Me and my little car.
Yeah, I can attest the travel north on I-5 was bad.
If it's coming this way, it's going to wash out everything. Oh. I tell you, what a mess.
Okay, we'll start around the sign-up sheet.
Am I supposed to be going? I need to borrow a pen from somebody. I got to grab the wrong notebook. Thank you. All right. Thank you for coming. Let's go ahead and approve the meeting minutes from our 7/21/2016 meeting.
Well, unfortunately, we do not have a quorum.
Oh, we don't?
We only have four commissioners out of the six required for the
Oh, okay. So I guess we pass on that to our next meeting, which
January.
Will be January.
Huh?
Okay. Well, I made it up here. Where are the rest of them? Jeez.
Yeah.
If they're around the corner, I'm going to be mad in some office building somewhere. So anyway. Okay. Then let's go ahead and do the NHTSA update with Greg.
Thank you very much. Seated or? Oh, got to go up front.
Go up front. Yes, please, where I can see you.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for the invite. It's an honor to be here with you. Darren, thanks again for the invite. Again, my name is Greg Fredrickson. I work with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration in Region 10. Our states that we deal with are Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. And so it's a pleasure to be here with the commission today. Our primary partner in the state is the commission. So we take highway safety grant funds from the federal government and we grant them to the state to affect highway safety issues within the state of Washington. And so we try to pull up alongside the state and help the state solve some of the issues that you may have. And so we have set up what we call the national priority programs, and those deal with the typical ones such as impaired driving programs and occupant protection and bike ped and those types of programs. But again, our primary relationship within the state is with this commission. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to stand here today and chat with you. I just want to discuss really primarily three numbers. And the first one is 35,092. The second number is 568. and the third number is 94. From a federal perspective, 35,092 people lost their lives in 2015 in highway traffic safety-related fatalities. So we lost 35,000 plus people last year, and the preliminary numbers for this year is that's going up. So the preliminary numbers in 2016 indicate a rise in that as well. And so that's the bad news. I talked a little bit about, I mentioned 568. That's the number of fatalities that the state of Washington experienced last year. That was up from 2014 from 462. So we're seeing a trend in the region. In Region 10, we're seeing an increase in fatalities, traffic-related. And so that last number is important, is 94. 94% of these issues are caused by behavioral issues, problems, people making bad decisions. We've all seen people have too much to drink and get behind the wheel and drive home. We've all seen that. They know they shouldn't be doing it, and we know they shouldn't be doing it, but they make this decision, and so they make choices. And so I'm looking for ways to impact and help people make better choices when it comes to transportation, getting behind the wheel. How can we help people make better decisions? We've seen people that are too tired to drive, they're driving. We're finding in research that drowsy driving is just as bad as impaired driving under the influence of alcohol and drugs. And so this drowsy driving thing has come to the forefront. Dr. Rose Kine, the administrator at NHTSA currently, has brought this drowsy driving program to the forefront and said this is a problem that we're seeing, and we've all experienced that. So, you know, how can we help people make better decisions when they get behind the wheel? How can we impact that 94% that is the problem in the states across the country? 94% of our fatalities are caused by people making bad choices. So we come up with, I mentioned the national priority programs, the impaired driving and the occupant protection, child passenger safety, pedestrian, bikes, all these programs to help the state focus on some issues that are of national importance, national attention. We also have a pot of money out there that's very flexible, and we ask the states to become really innovative, really start thinking about what is the local problem. And so we want to bring these programs and solve local issues locally. And so we want this partnership to work very, very well, and how can we help solve some of these local issues? And so there's a pot of money that's very flexible that we can use for any other types of projects not within the national priority programs. And so I'm open to suggestion because, again, like I said, Region 10, the one that I'm responsible for, experienced a 20% increase in fatalities last year. 20%. We led the nation. The national average was 7.2% increase. And so Region 10 really stood out. And so my mission is to determine what is the problem and how do we solve those. And so I'm reaching out to each and every one of us. How can we help people make better decisions when they get behind the wheel? How can we do that? We have to hold the line on the programs that we are implementing right now. And we're doing a dang good job. All of our partners at the table are doing everything that they're really good at. And they're doing a dang good job. And we thank you each and every day for doing that. What is there that to be done? What can we do, right? What can we do? What can be done to help people make better decisions? These are choices. And so, you know, the point that I'm trying to make is safety is local. Safety is personal. This 35,092 figure, those are moms and dads, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles. And so we need to personalize that if we can. And we need to help people make better decisions so this impact to our family is lessened through this traffic safety dilemma that we have that has just absolutely befuddled us. So I reach out. I'm open to ideas on anything, traditional or non-traditional. I'm open to anything that will help people make better decisions. And so I open this partnership up, and I commit to this, Darren, that as we pull up alongside, let's go to work and solve issues. Let's solve problems together. And, you know, we have a good track record, and I hope to continue that. We have issues, and I just want, on highway safety, I just want to address those. What do we need to do, and how can we get there? And I just open this up to this group that are committed to highway safety. How do we reduce that number of fatalities and serious injuries in our state? How do we do that? And so we can transfer that to other states in the region and nationally. Washington is unique. We have a marijuana law now, and it's legal. So it makes us unique here in Washington. We have additional issues that we have to deal with over and above what the standard state is dealing with. And so the eyes of the nation are on us, looking at us and what we're doing in response. And so I just wish you well in that mission. If there's anything that we can do in the NCC Region 10 office, please give me a call, and we will partner with you every step of the way, every day. That's my role. The partnership with this commission is vital to us being successful in the state of Washington. So I wish us very well in that mission again. I'm open to suggestion on anything that would help us lessen the number of victims that we're seeing out on our highways. It impacts all of us. So, again, thank you so much for allowing me to come here today, Darren. I really appreciate it. It's an honor to stand before this body, and I enjoy being here. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Greg. Appreciate it. It's a mess.
If okay. I can take a second, Darren.
Yes, Darren. Be my guest, Darren.
We've had a really strong relationship with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Federal Highway Administration, for many years. And with NHTSA particularly, Greg was our program manager back in 2012, and then he left us to go to California, where there was some sunshine, as the Deputy Regional Administrator. But Greg's been very, very focused and committed on helping us as a state, and he's always been looking for kind of those innovative ideas and some thoughts about, hey, you know, this is what we have done, but what can we do outside of the box? And I really appreciate now he's coming back as a regional administrator to help push some of these thoughts and ideas that from that top-tier level for us as a region. Because it's, as we know, we see the numbers, you know, so many different people coming in from Oregon and Idaho and Montana and some of these other areas around the region. But when we look at what we're doing as a state, what we're seeing nationwide, I think we're doing a lot of good things. It's just how do we help deploy those resources to then affect, you know, some of those issues. We know that law enforcement's on the tip of the spear when it comes to traffic safety. Education is a key component of that. Engineering in the EMS. And so all of those programs really focus through with these grants that we have we receive through NHTSA every year is to help us to make sure that we don't lose sight of that personal impact from a property damage crash to a serious injury crash to a fatal crash, because they all have impacts on all of us as individuals, and we've all been impacted by it. So, and that's what we're committed here to do, and that's why we're here today, is really to make that difference. So I thank you, Greg, for being here and voicing again your support as the new region administrator. You've been on the job for 10 days?
Maybe.
So, but we're excited to start kind of a new chapter here with you and your staff, so exciting. Thank you.
Yes, Roger.
Yeah, it's great. Welcome. I'm no longer the new kid on the block. That's one of the things that I've been thinking about, you know, we've talked about education and enforcement and engineering. I've been thinking a little bit more about engineering writ large. I was back at the AARP Livable Communities Conference talking to a friend of mine who's the planning director in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and they're looking at the relationship between, you know, land use and these issues. Brought back to mind one of my favorite definitions of smart growth, get drunk, walk home, smart growth. You know, and it's not implying you should, you know, go get drunk, but if you're going to get intoxicated, or your son or your daughter, your mom, whatever, wouldn't it be nice if they were within walking distance of home? And, you know, how many communities in the state of Washington will permit a tavern in a neighborhood?
Right.
Where do they put the tavern? They put the tavern out on the highway, making it impossible to, if you're going to go and consume alcohol, you have to drive to do it. So are we looking at our built form, our built environment, and its relationships? Not just the engineering of the highway, but it's the design of our communities. Are we putting, travel is all about getting from here to there. Are we putting here and there together? I was talking with the director of Seattle DOT, and he was very proud of the fact that they're creating 160,000 jobs in central Seattle and 40,000 units of housing. And I was like, great, that's 120,000 new customers for the Washington State DOT that we don't have the room for. And those are the people who are driving distracted and driving tired.
So I think we need to keep doing what we're doing, but I'd encourage, you know, NHTSA and as we talk about this relationship, can we broaden that to look at, are we, by the way we develop our communities, creating unsafe situations? And is that yet another reason for mixed use and some of the things that we're trying to do for a variety of reasons around the state of Washington? So I'll get off my soapbox, but since you're brand new, I thought I'd get that opportunity in. Thank you.
Well, there's so many communities, you know, that the comprehensive plan is required, it's updated, and, you know, it's tough to even get people to sit on planning commissions in a small city or any city to do the work. But at least we're in the small town that I remember, small city that I represent, people really value being able to walk to the grocery store and that sort of very small, compact town, and we're requiring more sidewalks and that sort of thing. But it is very difficult on land use to get the people in that to really understand it, to begin to kind of turn it. But Roger's exactly right, because we're running out of land, especially in the central Puget Sound area. We can't do this, you know, 60 miles, 60-minute commute anymore, and that was just a fallacy anyway. So I think that ultimately it can be, you can start changing it, because folks are really looking at not necessarily the suburbs and the picket fence anymore. They're really looking at other values that they that are above all that. And it might be a good time to begin to incorporate and understand that more. And there's tons of resources out here to help us understand that, make that a component. And I have a master's in planning, so that I love when Roger talks about planning. It just makes my heart sing. Okay, let's move on to the Pedestrian Advisory Board and legislative updates, and that'll be Shelley.
All right, good morning. You're my favorite group to address. You always ask the best questions of me. I'm going to talk about legislation and pedestrians, and since we were on the topic of land use, I'm going to go ahead and start with the Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council. That was legislatively mandated that we get together a group, Traffic Safety Commission, and we are charged to review, analyze data related to pedestrian fatalities, serious injuries, to identify points at which the transportation system can be improved, and to identify patterns in pedestrian fatalities and serious injuries. So a very long charge to say we're getting together, we're looking at pedestrian safety in all kinds of ways. And the reason that we're focusing on pedestrians, not just because we were asked to do so by the legislation, but pedestrian fatalities in our state have been really, really flat. 60, 65 people a year since 2005. When the rest of traffic fatalities was enjoying declines, pedestrians were flat. As everything else increased in 2014, pedestrians went up to 67, so a nice small bump. But in 2015, they went up to 87. 20 more. Huge increase in pedestrian fatalities. So we do want to address it. I think when we first developed Target Zero, we actually said a high tide will float all boats, and as we decrease impaired driving, pedestrians are going to benefit from that, and we're going to increase, you know, pedestrian safety. But we're still, it was so flat, it hasn't really played out the way we thought it would. So we're taking a very hard look at pedestrians. Very excited about what we're finding. Land use and having planners at the table with us on the Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council has been a key piece. As you said, if people can walk, that changes the whole dynamic. And we know that when people are walking and speeds are low, they're more likely to survive. So if a pedestrian's hit at 20 miles an hour, they have 1 out of 10 is going to end up in a fatal. And 9 are going to survive. If it's at 30 miles an hour, it's 50-50. 5 of them die, 5 of them survive. And if it's above 40 miles an hour, only one of them is going to survive out of 10. So we know, there again, land use, speed, what's happening on our roadways really affects pedestrians. And when we looked at what's happening with a driver when we have a pedestrian crash, about a third of the time, there's no factor with the driver. The driver was doing what the driver was supposed to do. But about a third of the time also, the driver's distracted.
when we look at what's happening with pedestrians, the most striking thing is that 44% of pedestrians that are killed in fatal collisions are impaired at the time of the crash. For us, this is a really distinct problem because they're doing the right thing. Maybe they've walked and they're walking home from a bar or an outing and they didn't want to drive, so they're walking. And we have never messaged to people that walking impaired can be really deadly. And yet we don't want to message to people and have them go, oh, well, then I'll drive, right? That's even worse. So we've found really interesting things, and this council has gotten together. Advocacy planners, both county and city, state DOT, John Nesbitt and I are steering committee members.
Co-steering
committee members.
We'll have to go a while to get that one, right?
Yeah. along with Monica Alexander and Dolly Fernandez at DOT, Monica Alexander and State Patrol.
DOH.
Thank you. wrong letters coming out of my mouth. So we have the injury prevention folks. We've got state and local law enforcement, engineering, active transportation planners, some new partners that we haven't worked with before. King County Metro is there. They've got a lot of data about interactions with their pedestrians. So as somebody exits a bus or comes to a bus, there are pedestrians in between those times. Bus crashes with pedestrians, looking at locations, looking at facilities around those locations. Are they encouraging pedestrians to dash across the street by where the bus stops? Things I hadn't thought about before. The King County Medical Examiner's Office is there, and they bring a whole new perspective because they don't just look at these statistics. They're actually up close and personal with them. A lot of good data coming out of that. So it's an exciting effort. We'll have our first report to the to the legislature due in December. We will share it with you all when we get it done. And then we'll have reports for the next 3 years after that as well. So the first report will be kind of basic, and then we'll be able to really deep dive into some issues that are puzzling us. We have, as we looked at this issue of impaired pedestrians, we've actually developed our first PSA around what to tell people about walking impaired. We're kind of excited. This is one in a series of six PSAs that we've developed around the concept of Target Zero. And if you'd asked me 5 years ago if we were going to start marketing the concept of Target Zero to the public in general, I would have told you, no. It's too complicated. They won't get it. It's a hard concept. And yet, in intervening years, we found that they are very meaningful to the concept about nobody should die in my family and nobody should die in the state. So we've developed some Target Zero messaging around that. I'm going to take a minute to show this to you. Isaac?
Well, I'll just intervene while this is warming up, just for a second, since I intervened. But just add to this is the when you're looking at changing a traffic safety culture, you know, being able to message this out, I think is kind of what you're saying, Shelley, is helping to affect that overall. Mark, for the rest of you.
Yeah, maybe a question or while we're waiting for the PSA, but the folks who are dying impaired walking, are they on the sidewalk or are they on facilities that don't have sidewalks? I asked that. Mm-hmm. I was at the Tribal Transportation Conference a few weeks ago, and you know, in Indian Country we have a significant issue with this. And I took I just took a test. I walked from the Sammamish Resort down to the village.
Yeah.
There's no sidewalk.
Yeah.
There are these great bus stops, little signs on poles, and you know, not even really a shoulder to walk on. And yet I saw people walking, seniors walking, and children riding bicycles and the rest. It was 45 miles an hour, and there was a fog line and about 6 inches of pavement on the side of it. And
exactly.
In a situation like that, where that individual did the right thing and walked home, we're putting him in an unsafe place.
Exactly. Yeah. we'll be taking deeper dives into that information, but preliminarily, we have people who are impaired who are lying in the roadway.
Yeah. Hit.
We have those kinds of situations
kind of
where
impaired,
they're county and back roads. Most of the crashes with pedestrians are happening in city areas, though. So
crosswalks and
And you know, King County Medical Examiner shared freely that a lot of the pedestrian crashes that are in his jurisdiction are transient population. So of those that are impaired. So there's lots of different things. Well, I don't know what's happening with that, and so we
this always
forward.
Amazes me.
And we'll send you a link to all six of the PSAs.
We were in the middle of Microsoft.
As soon as we have them all finalized, so probably next week. So I will move on to our legislative piece. In your packet, you have the new driver.
Okay.
We can watch that.
What hazards should you look for when walking home after too many drinks?
Cars turning right or left if they're in a crosswalk. Try to stay in well-lit areas.
Having a buddy or letting them know what you're doing so they don't get lost on the way home.
You want to look out for curbs, holes, manhole covers.
4 out of 10 pedestrians killed in traffic crashes are impaired.
Well, in disbelief, that's a lot higher than I thought it would be.
Wow, that surprises me.
I think walking home is a better alternative than driving when you're inebriated, but I think you still have to be safe.
Okay, so you had a few drinks and made the right choice to not drive. Now you gotta make it home safe. Every year in Washington, over 60 road fatalities involve pedestrians. Let's all have each other's back. If a buddy is looking wobbly on their feet, help them get home safely. Use a taxi, a ride share, or provide a shoulder for them to lean on. With your help, Washington can reach its goal of zero traffic deaths. Stay safe out there and take the Target Zero Pledge. We can't reach zero without you.
If a buddy is stumbling, I pledge to get him home safe.
I pledge to be aware of my surroundings when I'm walking home.
I pledge to sober up before I trip up.
Even when I'm on foot, I pledge to obey traffic laws.
I pledge to help reach zero.
All right, so we
got to
see.
I'm thinking bars with bunks might be a marketing thing.
What's that?
Bars with bunks. You know, just a sober up room in the back. Bars with bunks. Bar bunks.
I like it.
Yeah.
So, DOL has taken the lead on new driver legislation, along with traffic safety and the state patrol. We've submitted this request to the governor's office, so it is currently under their review. It includes all of the best research that we know about how to keep young drivers and new drivers safe. And we've put it all into a bill at the level at which everything that we know about says these are the most effective ways to work with new drivers. So we are expanding in the legislation. We're asking for expanded driver's education training for 18 to 20-year-olds. So as you know, right now it's only required for 16 and 17-year-olds. A lot of drivers are waiting until they're over 18 to get their license for the first time now, and we're seeing a bump in traffic fatals with that 18 to 20 year old age. We would like to require all newly licensed drivers to hold a permit for at least 30 days. So if you've never ever been licensed before and you're going in for your first time, regardless of whether you're 16 or you're 30, we'd say let's have a permit and learn how to drive for at least 30 days. For those that are over 20. And the reason is right now you can walk in without any training whatsoever and take the drive test. And if you, our drive test is really pretty simple. If you pass it, you have a license. We'd just like to give them a little bit of time for that training. Some things that we've known for a while about our intermediate driver's license law that have been less than ideal is the nighttime restriction. We've had it from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. If you look at when crashes are happening with young drivers, they're happening not during that time period anyway. So what we want to do is bump that up to 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. A lot of controversy around that. A lot of people go, oh, wait, my kid's got to do X, Y, and Z. And that's okay. We can write in as many exemptions to this. So we can say you're exempted if you're involved in school activities, church activities, work activities, whatever activities we want to write in there. And the law is still effective. From everything that research tells us, the reason it's effective is it gives parents the ability to monitor their children. And we know most people want to follow laws and they'll do their best. And if we can just restrict some of those aimless trips at night with teens and give parents the power to say, no, you don't get to go over to your buddy's house, you know, 2 months after you got your license, you've got to wait. I still have to take you. And then the family, I'm sorry, the passenger restrictions. So we know that other passengers in the car with teen drivers are some of the most distracting things that can happen. We see it all the time in teen crashes where there's got a car full of teenagers. Right now we allow one passenger for the first 6 months and then up to three passengers for the second 6 months after they first get their license. We'd like to expand that to only one passenger for the full year. And
with the exception of non-family, with their family.
Right, if family members are there, and there's been some discussion about foster kids, so we've changed the definition of family to make that clearer and to include a foster child driving with their foster brother. Behind-the-wheel practice hours, we currently ask for 50. They need to log those hours. 10 of those need to be at night. Best practice says the more time behind the wheel, the better they're going to be once they get on the road without the extra help. So we're expanding that, asking to expand that from 50 hours to 100 hours. And also looking at driver's education, specifically giving DOL the authority to do a little more monitoring and curriculum development there. So that's what that package looks like. It was a big stakeholder group, which I presented to you before several times, that developed these recommendations. There was a lot of thought put into them. They may sound a little strict, especially if you, like me, grew up in a time when the day I got my license, my mom sent me from Shelton, where I learned to drive, to Tacoma Mall, where I'd never been before. And I took that exit, and there were two lanes on the exit. I'd never seen a two-lane exit before. And my friend said, oh, that's the one you take. And so I swerved. I was in the wrong lane, and I swerved over to try to catch the exit. And my little blue 1972 Super Beetle hit an Impala. It was kind of like a tin can hitting a cannonball. Nobody was hurt, thank goodness. But I used all of my savings to fix the fender and to fix her car, since I wasn't quite insured yet, since it was my first day with my license. Yeah. These seem strict compared to that, but perhaps there's really good reasons for it. Any questions on the young driver bill?
Could you remind me again what the, for parents that don't pay attention to this thing, what's the punishment or what's the fine or whatever if a kid is caught breaking every rule there is on the intermediate driver's license? What's the punishment for the parents? Because I think there's a lot of parents that don't understand.
Right. So there's no direct punishment for parents. Intermediate driver's license restrictions are called secondary enforcement.
Okay.
Which means an officer can't look at a car and say, that kid looks like they might be under the age and it's after curfew and so I'm going to go pull them over. The child is already being pulled over for another offense. They're speeding, they ran a red light, they're swerving, whatever. They're pulled over. If they have an intermediate license, then the officer gets to take that additional action on if they're violating their intermediate license as well. The first violation, a letter is sent home to parents, and it says basically, we know statistically that when your child has a traffic violation in this early time period, they are much more likely to be in a serious crash. Mm-hmm. The second violation, they're suspended for 6 months. And the third violation, they're suspended until they're 18.
Okay.
As we add 18 to 20-year-olds onto this, the letter goes, instead of to the parent for the 18 to 20-year-olds, the letter goes to the actual driver with the same things. And then the 18 to 20-year-olds aren't in this legislation subject to the suspensions.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Yeah. So, Shelley, has there been any analysis done? You know, somewhere in the last 10 years, Glenn might know this, the driver's ed system changed dramatically. We've lost the subsidy for low-income people. Schools are not doing it as much, so we've changed access. Some of these, you know, interventions here make me wonder if we've analyzed that at all, about the impact of those changes. Are there more kids going to 18 and not going through driver's ed? You know, those kinds of things.
Yeah, so it's had some impacts, we think. But AAA just did a very large survey about kind of trying to get at this delayed licensure. And what they found was it's a different generation of kids, too. Mm-hmm. So kids don't have cars. Cars are very expensive. Insurance is extremely expensive. So driver's ed being slightly more expensive is really about what you spend to send your kid to the prom in relationship to all the other expenses your teenager is
it's about $350 in Longview.
The prom or driver's ed?
Tech class.
Yeah.
And you spend about $800 on prom if you got a girl.
Yeah. I'm just saying that there's a lot of focus on that.
Yeah, just curious
amount.
If there was any.
And the amount is not tremendous in terms of, yeah. of the other.
Well, the subsidy was really targeted to low-income kids. So,
so what AAA found was the number one reason that they don't have a license or that they would delay their licensing is that they don't have a car or access to a car. They can get around where they need to go without having their license, which is different, I think, than when I was a kid, probably. And then, you know, that it's expensive, that they can't get insurance. So those kinds of things are... Mm-hmm.
So are we seeing more kids not doing driver's yes. ed and going to 18?
Yes, okay. we are definitely seeing that. That's definitely true. But I think it's for a multitude of reasons.
Yeah, that's good.
And then we're seeing this bump in crashes.
Yeah.
So we would like to address that.
So, Martin, and for the rest, on page 114, well, actually, it starts, I think, in
10
and through is the analysis for young drivers in the new Creative Care with Safety Plan. And then there's just some analysis there about the age of licensing versus age of fit and crash from 16 up to 20. So there is some different analysis in there and the infractions and that kind of thing. So
yeah, a very good discussion.
Yeah.
From all of our latest and greatest now. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we're now talking about, with Mark, the Texas A&M survey results leveraging and enhancing alcohol counter measures.
All right. Again, I'm Mark Dallin with the Longview Traffic Safety Commission. I'm one of the impaired driving program managers here, along with Etika Esqueda in the back there. I'm pass out. The agenda is a little bit misleading. We don't have the actual results yet. We do have some information from the surveys that they did here in our state. At July's commission meeting, I mentioned that I was contacted by the Texas A&M Transportation Institute, so TTI. A lot of you are familiar with that. They're a big research group. They do awesome traffic safety, transportation safety research. They contacted our state. They contacted me asking if we would participate. We are actually one of five locations in the country. So they came to Washington. They were in Washington, D.C., Denver, Colorado, Atlanta, Georgia, and Irvine, California was the fifth and final location. So they are in the process right now of writing up the report based on the information that they received from what they called subject matter experts. So they contacted us and asked us to provide them with names and contact information for subject matter experts that deal with impaired driving prevention. So I love our commission structure. These are the times when it makes our job really easy. We have a commission structure. We have groups such as the Washington Impaired Driving Advisory Council. We just went through that. I worked with Lieutenant Sharp at State Patrol and a couple others. We went through the White Act list. We picked out kind of a good variety of players that would be ideal to invite to this. So on August 9th, we met at CJTC, the Criminal Justice Ring Commission of Burien, and had about 20 representatives from the White Act group, from the Career Driving Advisory Council. They represented law enforcement, courts. There were prosecutors there, some of our traffic safety resource prosecutors, Amy Friedheim from King County, Liquor and Cannabis Board was represented, licensing, some from the state tox lab, tribes, prevention, treatment. So we've got a good variety of impaired driving prevention, subject matter experts from our state. You'll see kind of the discussion guide is what I passed out. That is what we used as our for the day. It was about a 7-hour day. That's what we use as far as the schedule. There's some background information in there. And you'll see the questions, the discussion points that were in there, some of the survey. They asked us to rank certain things. So upon completion of the discussion, PTI distributed a list of identified alcohol-based countermeasures to us to be used as a template for comparing their identified countermeasures to those countermeasures identified in the literature review. From both lists, we were asked to rank our top five alcohol-impaired driving countermeasures that held the most promise for detecting and deterring drug-impaired driving. One of the reasons they said, one of the reasons that they contacted Washington State as well as Denver, Colorado, was their legalization of marijuana. They wanted to see how that has been affecting Dr. Hoppus. I'm sure you're going to be coming with some great follow-up information here right after this. So we are seeing an increase in drug-impaired fatalities in our state. So they wanted to kind of see how the legalization of marijuana had played into that. So we selected our top five countermeasures, and we scored our selections based upon effectiveness, barriers, timeliness, costs, and adaptability. This was done so that an overall list of and ranking of countermeasures could be created and discussed as a group. So the Seattle group, the Washington group, I should say, identified five countermeasures as the most promising for preventing drug-impaired driving. It was pre-offense education, sobriety checkpoints, high visibility, aggressive enforcement, media, and last but not least, A-RIDE, Advanced Roadside Impaired Driving Enforcement. So those were the top five countermeasures that we as a group came up with. The PTI team acknowledged they would not have been able to accomplish this action and you know, complete the survey without the help of the WIDAC. So all of us have some participation in the project. So thank you all for sharing your experts with us. We'll share the final report once it's completed. They promised that we should have it in the next 1 to 2 months. They expect to release it by the end of the year, calendar year. We will share that with all of you. Hopefully I'll have some information I can bring from that report to January's meeting. If it's released before that, I'll have Darren send out an email. We can distribute electronically. So that's just some of the high-level highlights. Any questions on what Texas A&M did and how this all went down?
They got out of Texas in August, so that was pretty small. Came out here.
Yeah. So how many people participated again? There were about 20 from Washington State, 20 subject matter experts, as they call them.
Well, to have a group, well, first of all, for Texas A&M to reach out to our state to begin with, was a huge kudo to us as a state. Number two is Mark taking the lead on this. Thank you very much for doing this. And Epiketica, you were kind of prodding him along.
You kept me straight.
Yeah. but ultimately is having a group that you can reach out to without thinking who do we need to call is we already have an infrastructure to build from to then draw folks from that, those subject matter experts, to address this. I've been all over the country, up to Canada, on the impaired driving issues with, well, legalization and the impacts of impaired driving. And it's amazing to me to see where states don't even have a group that they can call upon. You know, when I talk about the Traffic Safety Commission and show the photos of all of you, so you, if you ever feel your ears burning a lot, that's because we're up there, your picture up on the screen. But really being able to draw from that expertise to then work on issues that they have. So I think sometimes we may take it for granted what we have, and I think this was another clear example, and for them to reach out to Mark, and I think even some of the emails were like, wow, thanks for the quick response, because you had some people you could just say, here's the list, and I think that they were shocked that we had that type of information and contacts that we could go out immediately.
They actually mentioned that they struggled in a couple other states to get enough people, and they did. They were able to do it, but they said it was a struggle. We actually invited enough people that when five or six people were unavailable, or we had two that just due to scheduling had to back out the day before, and we were still at plenty, yeah, which was a nice thing, you know, nice problem to have.
Yeah. So great work on this, Mark.
There were
thank
some
you for
pretty heated discussions, but it was spirited. It was great to see even our group, I felt like, you know, we meet quarterly with WIDAC, and we're really involved. And yet, they're asking a lot of, they wanted their personal insights. They wanted their personal feelings and their personal experiences on the effectiveness of a lot of these, on a lot of these prevention pieces. And, you know, there's differing views on this works, this doesn't. What we need is this. No, we don't. What we need is this. And it was great. And the Texas people, we couldn't write fast enough. It was a good one.
So as the rookie, what is WIDAC?
Washington Impaired Driving Advisory Council. Sorry.
That's all right. I was a planner. I've been using them all the time.
It's we meet quarterly. It's a group that was established, gosh, probably, it was back in
2009.
Yes, thanks.
Yeah.
We have a charter, a strategic plan. And in fact, we're working on updating the WIDAC strategic plan.
That's right.
Because it is a few years old. So initially, back in, 2007, New Mexico was kind of the first state. They did a pilot study bringing groups together, you know, like us here, but multidisciplinary, addressing, you know, a variety of, I think, the impaired driving issues, but really it was the fostering leadership. You want to jump in here anytime you want to. But it was a fostering leadership grant. And then Washington State applied for it. We got the grant with, it's from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Thank you, Greg. I know you were the one that gave us the money. But that group then came together to address some of your top priorities as far as impaired driving. And looking at that, they had the whole leadership model of how we were going to do that. And then it's expanded now to where now the federal funds, we have used all those for certain impaired driving projects and programs. And now that is continuing, because it's like the intent was is to get the program up and running. And now we have state funds that come into that to help support that through the penalty, actually part of the fee for the BAC machine.
Okay.
And so, and then we're also this year working on trying to get the fee so when we draw blood, that there will also be. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm shaking my head, yes.
There's excitement back there, I tell you.
So that's kind of the group. And and now Mark, Etika are the leads on that and doing a great job. So it's a good group and amazing from all the different aspects.
And I take every opportunity I can to say that Shelley made our job really easy.
Yep.
Before Shelley was doing the legislative and media relations stuff, she was managing the impaired driving program all by herself in the state, so for the Traffic Safety Commission. So I appreciate everything that she set up, and we always say that it took two of us to come in and do what she was doing before. So thank you, Shelley. Thanks, Mark.
Well, quite the honor. Thank you. Now we have the marijuana update and upcoming projects with Stacy for the transportation safety.
Gotta have PowerPoint when there's data. Thanks for having me again to address this group. I was at the WIDAC meeting last week, so was perhaps already the same presentation you guys saw, so you guys have a little bit of jump on the information. But I want to go back to what Commissioner Millar said about he said a key word for folks who have background in public health, like myself, the built environment. So I love hearing that conversation, whether it comes through built environment or planning, because in public health, when I was there, I mean, that was a conversation that we've had for a long time on how it affects health. It just makes sense to do it in traffic safety, too. So thank you. And the WIDAC, I'll just echo, is an amazing group. I participate in lots of advisory councils and groups. WIDAC is one that always impresses me every time I go. The caliber of the people there are not only decision makers, but people there who are actually on the ground doing this stuff every day. So it's incredible. I'm going to go through a little bit quickly, try to not cut into Darren's time too
quick.
Please
cut into my time.
Okay.
This is important.
So we finally got our roadside survey back from NHTSA. There's a nationwide roadside survey that's been happening since the 1970s. This was a special project that PIRE and NHTSA put together and came in to do for Washington State. They came in right before retail sales started. I-502 passed well before actual recreational stores opened. So this was about the opening of the recreational stores. Came in right before, and then came back again 6 and 12 months after those stores opened. So they did three waves, is what they called them, of data collection, mirroring the methodology they used for the National Roadside Survey in Washington State. And among those three waves, they got almost 2,400 people to provide biological samples and respond to a survey while they were going through this whole thing. So it's a good sample sizes, although there was some variability between these sites that did cause some issues with analysis that I'll talk a little bit more about. But I believe this is the link to the report here, but I believe, Jerry, you were going to send it out to the group if they haven't got it already. Okay. So this is, I know, a busy chart, but I wanted to show kind of all the different ways that they looked at this. So the easiest way to interpret this is here. If it's connected by an actual trend line, that means that those results were statistically different from wave one. They did not compare wave two and three together. They compared everything to wave one. So this is the pre-sales. This is 6 months post-sales compared to wave one, and 12 months post-sales compared to wave one. So the only significantly different findings that they found between these waves was the daytime use, which is interesting, but also mirrors what we've seen in our preliminary analyses of fatal crash drivers who have THC on board, is that it doesn't look like alcohol. It's not weekend, nighttime. It's every day of the week during the day that we're seeing it a lot. And that was a very big jump from wave one to two that we also saw echoed in wave three, 12 months after. So what I kind of say is you can kind of consider this the new prevalence norm on the roadways for now until we can get out and do more outreach and education about driving under the influence of THC. Just under 8% prior to sales, jumped up to over 18% in wave two and 19% in wave three. And again, those were significantly different from the pre-sales. The other, only other significant finding that they found, which is actually a win, it's kind of opposite, was the number of those THC positive drivers that were over that 5 nanogram per se limit that we've established in Washington State. So prior to sales, it was just under 15% of drivers were over the per se as well. 6 months after sales, that had significantly dropped to 5%. In wave three, it was 9%, but this was not significantly different from the 14% initially. And again, that could be one of those issues with the variation they saw between the sites that made that not a significant difference. But this is a good sign here. That means that some of the early outreach efforts that we did with traffic safety were, I can't tie them directly to it, but of course, being in this industry, I'll go ahead and say that it's our efforts that helped right after those sales, get the word out and hopefully have a higher understanding among drivers that it's not okay to do that. And in fact, it's illegal. So the other measures that you see on here is nighttime. Just like other substances, it is higher at nighttime. So when you see the more high-risk driver composition on the roadways anyway, so it was about 17% pre and between, well, these are not significant, so you could imagine 18 to 23% at any time were under the influence of THC. Same thing with all time. So regardless of day or night, just group everything together. There was about 14% and then 20% and 22%. So a slight increase, but again, not significantly different. So you could think of these all as just point-in-time prevalence estimates, which is what this chart shows. So because there was a lack of significant difference between these waves, what I was able to do is just take those three estimates, group them together, and come up with an average to describe general prevalence or frequency of THC drivers on the road at any one time. So that's what this chart shows. What's missing from this chart is alcohol, so kind of get alcohol out of the mind for now. The focus was THC. So drugs, not including alcohol, approximately 65% of drivers didn't have any drugs. That's good news. The bad news is that means 35% of drivers did have some kind of drugs in their system. The list of drugs that they screen for is huge. It includes over-the-counters like Benadryl that can impair driving performance, cough syrups, things like that, medications like muscle relaxers, even painkillers that can be illicit or medication, and then, of course, your suite of illicit drugs, your cocaine, your THC, and all those things. So focusing in on THC, combining these two together, that's the 18.5% average that you saw of THC drivers. But only 11.5% of them were THC only, so we are seeing that combination of THC with those other drugs. Medications only were 15%, so a lot of people will ask that question, well, is it just people, you know, that have a prescription? And with a prescription, there's a potential for abuse. But yeah, they were able to kind of categorize the drugs they tested for to look at that, and 15% were medications. And then there's illegal drugs mixed with medication, a very small percentage. So let's consider alcohol in this. If we consider alcohol, then approximately 62% of drivers were not under the influence of anything. So where does alcohol fit in? There's the THC. Here's the combinations of alcohol here. Here's the other drugs, which is that illicit medication from the previous slide. Here, alcohol use is really low. It's unfortunate that we see any alcohol on the road still at this point, but comparative to drugs, this again follows the discussion we've been having for several years when we've seen the frequency of drug-positive drivers increase while alcohol continues to decline. Okay, so before I jump into this, that was kind of a big high-level overview of the roadside survey. Is there any questions I can answer about that?
Yeah, it's the presence of THC, but as it stays, are these people who are under the influence of it or just present in their body?
Active THC. So this, in doing the roadside survey, they weren't able to delineate between THC and carboxy-THC, the metabolite. The difference, too, about these measures as compared to when we're looking at it in fatal crashes is there's not the time lag. When these people are stopped, they agree to participate, they give a blood sample. So it's not the whole adjudication and arrest process that can delay and affect those levels. So yeah, this is truly people under the influence at the time.
So this is people that are high as opposed to people who got high the night before.
High is one of those weird words. Yes, yes. Within the last 3 to 4 hours they've used, most likely for most users, not chronic.
Okay.
But
great.
So let's talk about 2015 and what happened in 2015. Greg Gray gave a great overview of what's happening in 2015. Washington specifically, outside of the whole Region 10, was a 23% increase in traffic fatalities in 2015. And people, of course, have asked, what is it? You know, what happened? What people can wrap their mind around the most is the numbers, so that's what's here. Proportions of these factors involved in fatal crashes look slightly different. So we won't talk about that today. Let's talk about numbers. Where exactly did we see the increase? And here we focused on the top two, and also when that increase was higher than the general increase we saw in the state, which was 23%. So is distracted driving increased 30.8%. Distracted driving is a tough one. We see it out there every day. We all feel like it's increasing. Very, very subject to reporting, very sensitive to how officers are reporting that and investigating that. But 30% in 1 year is not likely to be a reporting change. It's an increase in frequency. And then our older drivers, 70 and up, which is a new definition in Target Zero that you have in front of you. Previously it was 75 and up, so fantastic analysis by the DOL showed that driver error is notably different at age 70 and extremely different at age 75. So we revised the definition to 70. So just like we've all been expecting, the older drivers, our population composition is changing, so is our driver composition. That does not mean they're at fault, it just means their involvement is increasing. And then bikes, the numbers were small, but as Shelley alluded to, the increase in pedestrians and bikes, you kind of see that there. And drug-positive drivers have been increasing like this since 2010, so that wasn't a big surprise there. I had a lot of questions, though, when we had that increase. I have people calling me from other states all the time. It was marijuana, wasn't it? You are going up because of marijuana. Marijuana stayed exactly the same in 2014 versus 2015. So these numbers may have changed a little bit. The last time I looked at this was in April, but they haven't changed much, and this is what you can expect for marijuana. A 23% increase in fatalities, the number of those that involve marijuana is exactly the same. So it's not marijuana causing the issue. Now other drugs, as you can see here, and this includes marijuana drivers too, drug positive, we still have a drug issue. And that's how I try to message it when people are really narrow focusing on marijuana. You want to focus on marijuana. The killer is marijuana mixed with alcohol. That's what we see most frequently in fatal crashes, and that makes sense because that's a horrible combination. And then step back from marijuana a little bit and talk about the bigger drug issue, because that really is the bigger issue. So here's kind of an updated table from the marijuana report. We'll be releasing an updated marijuana report early next year. But I went ahead and added the 2015 here to see what's happening with THC. So THC-only drivers in 2015 increased just a little bit.
soda, THC, and alcohol over 0.08. Now, this is the concern. This right here is the question about that we just don't know the answer to. Is THC alone, not in combination with other drugs or alcohol, influencing drivers to cause crashes? We don't know the answer to that yet, but I have good news. We have a project coming up that will address exactly that, the first type of this project in the nation. So I'm super excited about that project. The other one here, THC drugs and alcohol, those guys are doozies, also increase about the same rate as THC and alcohol. So looking at THC alone, an increase, not too concerning. Looking at THC mixed with all the other things we see in fatal crashes, very concerning and a substantial increase. So kind of the same information, just graphically, so you can see those kind of three areas. Yeah, these are the three that I just focused on with THC. There's THC there only in the green, there's that small increase. But then here, THC drugs and alcohol over 0.08, and THC and alcohol over 0.08. What I like about this chart is when we talk about THC, the what we see most with THC in fatal crashes is THC mixed with alcohol. If you combine those two, THC, alcohol, and drugs, THC, and alcohol, we're looking at 36 drivers versus 24. So, and it's not surprising. Obviously, there's an interactive, impairing effect going on, because if you see it in fatal crashes at a high frequency, that's a scary combination. If it wasn't bad, if it wasn't causing some kind of impairment, you wouldn't see it in fatal crashes. So, and then what's equally fascinating about 2015 is, once again, the number of drivers with alcohol only was its lowest point in 2015, despite the 23% increase in fatalities. So that is a testament to the amazing work that happens. It's also concerning because that's just alcohol only. When we have a drug driving problem, we also have an alcohol combined with drugs problem. And I think on the horizon, we're going to be seeing more and more of that. So everything we can do to get ahead of this issue, we're going to want to do that. And then same thing, instead of drivers, though, this is just the number of fatalities, and these are not mutually exclusive groups. So the number's old. We added two and dropped one, so 568 now. But still, there's that 23% increase. Fatalities with any drugs involved. This is what I was talking about, that steady increase every year. Fatalities with any alcohol. And you do it that way just to compare it to drugs, because even though BAC 0.08 alone, nothing else is at its lowest point, we still have alcohol pretty consistently on the roadways. What's changing there, though, is the number of drivers above a 0.08 versus drivers below a 0.08, because we have a few of those as well. I think that's an important thing to evaluate when we start talking about per se limits for drugs. Because just like alcohol, just because you're not over a 0.08 doesn't mean we're not seeing 0.7 and below involved in these fatal crashes. There's still a risk there. So when we talk about per se for marijuana, especially with other states who haven't said it yet, what is the message we want to send? You set a per se, you're sending the message that a little bit is okay. So we want to be cautious of that. And then any THC, and that's regardless of whether it was combined with other drugs or not, is this low line. So again, no change in 2015. So let's talk about some exciting upcoming projects. Full disclosure, I hope you're happy with me here today, because we did invite Nick Loveridge from WSU, who's a major partner in developing the roadside THC detection test for officers. He couldn't be here today. And that is a complicated body of work, so I can't really speak to that body of work. So I'm going to talk about the ones that I can. So we have an analysis of self-report marijuana use. As part of the roadside survey, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety funded an effort to collect self-report data from all the drivers and passengers that participated in that study. Just this morning, I heard back from IIHS that they are moving forward with that analysis, and that we are interested in looking at it a couple different ways and partnering on a report and getting that information out. Unfortunately, that wasn't included in the NHTSA report, but I'm okay with that because we got the NHTSA report out sooner because that data didn't hold it up. So us and IIHS can handle that. We also have the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey. What's not on here, as well as the Healthy You Survey, both of which have questions regarding driving within a couple hours of using marijuana use. So in 2014, the first year that was on the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, was about 10% of drivers who had ever used marijuana reported driving within 3 hours. I don't know the number for 2015 yet, but we have the data, so you can expect this information to be included not only in our annual report, but also in the updated marijuana report coming out early next year. So regarding WSU and what they're doing with this roadside detection piece of equipment is part of that obviously is validating that sample against the blood sample. So it's a kind of a breathalyzer for detecting THC. So what WSU is doing is taking that breath sample from the equipment they're developing, taking an oral sample, and taking a blood sample, and then validating those results across all three. So we figured if you're getting people high, if you're measuring how high they are, and you're taking three different kinds of biological samples, why don't we do something to see what their level of impairment might be when we have these very specific levels of THC? Now, anybody familiar with the AAA studies that just came out? There's one of them in there that is just really, really interesting that basically showed the nanogram or any kind of blood level is not easily associated with impairment. So this is somewhat related to that, but we're not trying to associate it with the blood level. We're trying to associate it with what an officer might see going through standard field sobriety tests with these people. In addition to the high people, we're going to throw in some sober people, so the officers don't know who's under the influence. We're going to throw in some Visine, some perfume, all the stuff that you might see on the roadside to really get the officers doing the SFSTs to focus on the characteristics, the actions, and not other easy triggers like bloodshot eyes, smell, things like that. So we're partnering with the Pullman Police Department to do that. They've offered 20... No, not 20 officers. I think there's 20 people. Regardless of the number, they're offering A-Ride and non-A-Ride trained officers to do this. This is not going to be a generalizable study, which means it's going to be specific to what Pullman PD is able to provide and do. Very low sample sizes. So this is, to be very clear, is not an evaluation of the effectiveness of SFSTs or A-Ride training. Although Pullman PD will get some information specific to their officers about the value of A-Ride training. But the research question is, can these standard tools that officers have now for detecting impairment also detect impairment that's being caused by marijuana alone? So more to come on that. That should be wrapped up in a short time frame of about 12 months. So hopefully by this time next year, we'll have a preliminary report to be able to talk about then. Finally is the one that I'm super excited about that's going to get at the question about marijuana drivers causing fatal crashes. So in Washington State, we don't have that on the crash reform. And more complicated than that, in fatal crashes, it's not as simple as that driver caused it. A lot of the time, the fault can kind of be spread around all the drivers involved. That's why these are the most severe crashes. So what WSU is doing is we have 80 drivers that had THC only. They have the analytical data that we're all used to looking at, the tabulated data. We went ahead and set them the PTCRs as well, so they can look at the narratives, read the narratives, look at the diagrams, and manually assign peer culpability in these drivers, and then analyze them and compare them to alcohol drivers, analyze and compare them to drivers that are confirmed to not have any alcohol or drugs, and answer the question, what is the crash risk associated with consuming marijuana? We have some studies like that. What makes them different? Those drivers always have alcohol in their system. NHTSA did a great study in Virginia Beach, had some interesting findings, and then they controlled for alcohol and found nothing. They should have controlled for alcohol first. So that is the attempt here, is to just take alcohol out of the equation and focus on these drivers that we know have active THC, so recent use, and nothing else in their system to interact with it. That's where we start. So I'm excited about that. They have a grant to do that. And again, about a year from now, we're going to have this. So that's a great thing about doing research at this level, is we can churn it out pretty quick and get to some of these answers. And then not necessarily a project, but an increase in interest. Of course, there's a ton of interest in the special fatality data we have. Not every state has centralized toxicology we have, and not every state has a wonderful toxicologist that we have in the state. And more important, the relationship we have with the toxicologist to be able to share this data. And then even more important, get this out to the research community to do more and more work and review of this information. So just kind of an update on the list of users of this unique data set. We just released the preliminary 2015 toxicology data, so I anticipate by spring you may see some additional reports and additional projects from these data users, including the AAA, Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, Washington State University, WSU, in Pullman is the criminology department. WSU in Vancouver is now the sociology department, so it's really interesting to see all these different areas kind of looking at this as well. Department of Licensing gets the data, Washington State Institute for Public Policy, And more recently, National Institute of Health evaluators for the I-502 project reached out and included this data as well. So lots of stuff happening, more coming. We are continuing to compile and release this data, and I know that a lot of the answers, unanswered questions, those answers are going to come from Washington State, and with luck, they'll come very soon. So that's all I have. Any questions? I know that was a lot, and I talked really fast.
That's very interesting.
Good. Thank you. Now you can.
Thank you, Stacy. Appreciate it. Okay, Darren, director's report.
Well, again, segue from Dr. Hoff's comments is that, you know, we see the ongoing kind of fluidity of the change of impairment with drugs, different, you know, with marijuana. And how is that impacting us? How does it impact our overall goal for Target Zero? You know, when you look around what we're seeing across the state from either Target Zero, Vision Zero, Towards Zero, Deaths, whatever the initiative in the state is that many of the states are facing the same challenges we are. They're privatizing alcohol. They're, you know, legalizing either medical or recreational marijuana, which then adds another layer of complexity to traffic safety advocates to being able to address some of these issues. And so, you know, been around the country in different places and just seeing, I truly am grateful that we have this body here because they don't have all that in different states. Many of their traffic safety offices are buried in a DOT somewhere, no offense, or a public safety agency. But having that direct connection with the governor's office makes, I think, a big difference. What Stacy mentioned, too, was having a centralized toxicology. And talking to some of my peers across the country is, some of them have to send their results out of state to a contracting lab in order to get their results back. So just to kind of, you know, just to bring some things back, you know, despite all the challenges and the issues that we have, I think in many respects we're light years ahead of other states and what we're trying to do. The marijuana thing, you know, it's interesting because now it's, you know, as far as it's legalized, it allows for additional research in some areas. The federal government is looking at how to do that, as far as how that is managed, controlled, researched, because it's still against federal law. And you're still with universities. They have to maintain those standards and can't use a lot of this research on campuses. So they're having to find alternative ways to be able to do that research off campus. So it's been nice to, as an agency, to have the expertise that we have here in this office to be able to assist in some of that. So thank you, both Mark, Stacy, and Etika, if she was here, but for doing that and setting us up so that we have that. And before you, you have the Strategic Highway Safety Plan, which is now the new official version the governor has signed. Mike Gable, who we stole from the Department of Licensing and have no intentions of giving back, came in as the program manager to help facilitate this project because, as you all know, this is about an 18-month process. We redo it every 3 years. The FAST Act now requires that states do it up to every 5 years, so we've maintained our every three to maintain that, kind of trying to stay on top of those trends and those things so that we are... I think, as a state, maintaining that focus, that laser focus on what we're trying to accomplish. So this is also in electronic format through targetzero.com now. We'll have, so if you have resources and links that you want to go to, those will be hyperlinked for you if you want to have that additional information. This is one of those things, if you're going to be going to a conference, make sure that your bag is within at least the 40-pound tolerance because this will add an extra 10. But really, thank you, Mike, for taking the lead on this, because this is, as I think when you came in, didn't realize the amount of work, but now you have a greater appreciation for the amount of work that goes into this, as well as the collaboration between the data teams, the project team, and the steering committee. And our deputy director, Chris Medill, and John Nisbet over here, who hasn't introduced himself yet for those that may not know him, where the steering committee leads on this, and being able to really help to walk through. When you look at these individual chapters, these are written by those subject matter experts, not just, you know, people in our office, but folks within your respective agencies and around the state to help look at these the data and then the projects and what those objectives and outcomes are trying to be. So a lot of information in here. You know, some of the stuff that was mentioned, you know, I think earlier about, you know, some of the analysis on the young teen drivers. Some of that stuff is in here. And so we just really appreciate the level of detail that went into this report. And the governor has signed this. So now it is an official document that we shipped to the Federal Highway Administration and then is used also for our grant process with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. So a lot of work. Now, what also is extremely beneficial for this is now being able to use these in local communities. So now we've got a strategic highway safety plan is now looking at how can we implement these within our local communities, but also for local communities to look specifically at their own data. You know, because they may not have the same priorities as the state because the data is a little different, maybe demographics or whatever might be different, but it gives them an opportunity to take that snapshot of what their own areas and then implement some of these strategies that are there. Or, as you know, in December of this year, about mid-December, 19th, 20th, we'll be sending out the new grant solicitations for the federal fiscal year 2018 grants. 2017 just started about 3 weeks ago, and then we're going to start all over again in December. And then those announcements will go back out. We'll have the April commission meeting is where we will vote upon those final grants for the federal fiscal year 2018. But here is where local communities can now utilize this plan as they're drafting up their problem ID statements, gathering the data, looking at the projects. And if a community if they have a need and there's a project in here that doesn't necessarily need that, is that that grant proposal could come in as maybe doing a pilot study to see if there's another way to evaluate and assess some outcomes in their local communities. So great plan, a tremendous amount of work that was done by a lot of people in this room and our staff. And so my hat's off to them, so thank you very much. The Governor's Highway Safety Association Conference was a resounding success. I think some of you saw my email. Some of you were in attendance to that. We had about 560 attendees for a conference that averages about 420 to 440. So we were thrilled to have as many people that were here for the conference from a variety of basically all the disciplines. From law enforcement to probation to judicial to, you know, transportation and governor's office. And so all the different groups that are represented here at the table that were in attendance, being able to open up, it's a good thing you told me. I thought you were walking out of me.
I did tell you.
So, that's fine. So being able to have that conference here has opened up some great doors of communication, and being able to really, some dialogue that's been really amazing. So the conference next year will be in Louisville, Kentucky, and I know they're trying to outdo us, but I think we had a tremendous outcome. We had great weather, which was a great plus for us, and the venues, and a tremendous amount of information, the breakout sessions that we had about, I think, 17 different breakout sessions, plus all the general sessions, just a tremendous outcome, and thank you very much for Jerry and our staff being able to help coordinate this. GHSA does a lot of stuff behind this, you know, kind of the bulk of it, but we do kind of all the, you know, standing up and infrastructural things, and so Jerry was kind of the lead on that, and so we really give her a little round of applause for because that is a lot. Just to kind of give you a little update here, the Traffic Safety Commission, we are having some significant changes here in our office. MJ Hout just retired in September 1st, and we are just filling his or her position. I was hoping he was going to be here today representing DSHS, but we have replaced MJ Hout for the Tribal Traffic Safety Advisory Board and the Pedestrian Advisory Council with Scott Waller from the Department of Social Health Services. So we're very thrilled to have him coming over and joining our team. So he brings a wealth of experience, not only from the state, but from the behavioral science and arena to help us with a lot of our different programs here. So we're excited to have Scott coming on. Right after MJ retired, Chris Medill had posted his resignation. He's going on to the private industry, and so now I'm deputy directorless, and so I'll be looking to fill that position probably sometime after the election, after things kind of settle down. I'm looking at maybe some ways of changing the way we're structured here in the agency as well, and more to follow on that. Then we just received word from our administrative assistant four, Kathy Droke, who is now taking a position with the Washington Refuse and Recycling Association over in Lacey. And so she will be leaving us October 1st, so we'll be looking for a new AA4 here. So if you have anybody, you can...
Let us steal them, too.
We're all, you know, it's not plagiarism. It's just a sharing of ideas.
Yeah.
So anything that along those lines, I'll just kind of give you a little idea of what's happening internally. And so we're very excited about some of the changes we have. We have posted a grant with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. You know, we have the Fatality Analysis Review System here, a reporting system, which is FARS. They are now adding an additional piece to that called CRIS, and I will not even try to attempt to remember that. It's Collision.
Crash Reporting Sampling System, CRIS.
Yeah. Working for Stacy and Terry Ponton in our FARS analysis, or our RAD section, Research and Data Division. But ultimately is giving us an additional way of looking at that data that NHTSA would have. So we're looking at that. We're hoping we get that grant, and that will be an additional position here at the commission. We just seem to keep building and here. And that would be an additional grant specifically earmarked for that. Just a couple things just to share with you. The secretary mentioned a few minutes ago about the Tribal Traffic Safety Conference that we had. It was the Tribal and State Traffic Safety Conference, working specifically, we're out at the Suquamish Tribe, and it was a tremendous opportunity. We had 5 breakout sessions specifically just from the Traffic Safety Commission in conjunction with DOT. Had a good chance to be able to address some of the traffic safety issues that they are dealing with, looking at grant funding options, and some of the challenges that they face. And it was really exciting. We got to be able to share the new data video that we have, Recording Our Past, Protecting Our Future video that we've just created. It's about 10 minutes long. We showed it at the luncheon. So Celine Coquette, who is the councilwoman from the Cowlitz tribe, co-presented with me. And we also had the opportunity to co-present at the Centennial Accord. And so that was a good opportunity to be able to share traffic safety. The Traffic Safety Commission hasn't presented at the Centennial Accord since about 2009. So it was a great opportunity to be able to share some of the things that we're doing and then all of the videos and the outreach that we've had with the tribes through the Tribal Traffic Safety Advisory Board. It's a big acronym. So the TTSAB. So a lot of good things working in that arena, because we know that they are way overrepresented in fatal crashes, especially with pedestrians, as the Secretary was mentioning. You know, they just don't have a lot of the infrastructure on their reservations to address some of that. So there was some good conversations with Federal Highways, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and that about the different types of funding that's available to support them and their efforts. Like I mentioned, I've had the opportunity of sharing some things with Kansas at the AAA Drug Driving Conference. AAA, as you know, is a huge partner with us in this state, and they have reached out, had a good opportunity to share with them, and also for Montana at their Comprehensive Safety Driving Summit, or I'm sorry, the Safety Plan Conference. We, you know, it's interesting to hear, you know, Canada right now, their prime minister is looking at part of his platform was to legalize marijuana across all of the provinces, so it would be legal federally across the entire country. So I've had the opportunity to share a few things and been up there a couple of times to just share some of the, you know, issues that we have had, especially around the driving aspects. And it's really interesting to hear people come in, and I've had several people say to me, you know, I came in here, I didn't really know a whole lot about marijuana and drug driving, and now I walk away and I'm more scared than I've ever been. And it's not trying to create a fear factor or being afraid, it's just learning what it is and about the impacts that it can have. Because what we're dealing with marijuana is much different than what we dealt with 10, 20, 15, 30 years ago. It's the potency is much higher, the way that they're consuming it is different, not only just smoking, but all through to the vaping and inhaling, the edibles, the drinkables. I mean, there's a lot of different ways in which people are ingesting marijuana. And then what are those impacts? How quickly is the absorption? How long is that? You know, what about those that have used infrequently or used frequently? What are those impacts? That's stuff we really don't have a good grasp and handle on. So just kind of interesting to see what we're seeing across the states.
Lifesavers, the National Lifesavers Conference reached out to us right after right before GHSA, and we said we can't even think about Lifesavers until after. They wanted us to do the 2020 Lifesaver Conference in Seattle. However, we have committed to doing two traffic safety conferences here in the state, one in 2018, which will be spring of 2018, and another one in 2020. We felt like we wanted to just kind of keep our focus on in-house. And then we said that we would look at doing 2023 as a potential venue for the 2023 Lifesavers Conference here in Washington. But I think many people put us on the radar because of the turnout that we had, but also because of the talent and skill we have in this office to be able to manage something of that magnitude. But it is a lot of work to do those. Trying to zip through here really quick. Oh, the one thing I just wanted to share in relation to what Stacy mentioned, I just returned back from the ICP conference where I sit on the drug recognition, whether they call it the drug evaluation classification. It's a technical advisory panel. And one of the discussions there is that there is some jurisdictions looking at specifically addressing, well, IPTM out of Florida, which is the International Police Training Management or whatever it is. But it's out of Jacksonville, Florida, and they're looking right now at actually doing some evaluation on standard field sobriety tests that go beyond just looking at alcohol, which ours really are right now, are calibrated for. It is looking at how do we do some additional divided attention tests around marijuana and other types of drugs so that officers roadside have a different way of maybe employing some things that might help them as far as some observations. Because, frankly, when you look at marijuana and alcohol, too many people want to equate them, you know, especially with the signs and symptoms, which they're very different, very different. One is lipid soluble, which is marijuana. Alcohol is water soluble. The way it ingests in the body, the way it's the body uses it, and those impairing elements are much different. And it's being able to give the officers roadside the ability to look at different things in order to help them make some determinations. The Foundation of Advancing Alcohol Responsibility and the Governor's Highway Safety Association last year in Chicago, Shaquille O'Neal came in and did a presentation and an announcement about having grants for DRE and ARI training from FARS and from GHSA. Those funds are going to be available again. We'll make application again, right, Mark? Because they had four states, they had 22 applications, they had four states that were awarded those, which was Florida, Nevada, Illinois, and Texas. The intent is to get more DREs and more people trained in ARI. It's not to supplement, or I'm sorry, not to replace what you do already, but to help supplement, especially in areas where they need the help the most, especially with the DRE and ARI training, which is the Advanced Roadside Impaired Driving Evaluation. The funds this year, we're hoping that it will be four additional states. The grants from last year trained 70 new DREs and 470 new ARI officers. So that's great to have a private partnership that will help push funds into the system to help nationwide in the ways that they can. So, at the GHSA conference, I'll just... I don't know if you all know, but I was voted in again as the executive secretary for the GHSA. So once again, I'll be able to share a lot of things that were happening here at the national level, being able to work with the executive board with GHSA. So it's been a great year. A lot of things. I think we're very disappointed seeing where our fatality rates are. I think right now we're just below where we were last year, but pretty on track.
Yeah, it looks the same as 2015. And
yeah.
By the end of it all,
I'm not going to give you the numbers because it just totally depresses me. So, but I really do appreciate your attendance here and the participation, the support that your agencies give us, the staff that you have that are working with ours, and being able to really look at things and challenging different processes to make a difference. Because as we do, then we'll be able to see once again that impact in people's lives and reaching Target Zero. So thank you, and Madam Chair, that is my report.
I would like to personally thank Darren and Jerry and the whole staff, because I think walking around with my badge, and I was a Washington, people really loved the conference, and it was so smooth, and everything went so well, and it was so friendly, and the hotel was wonderful, and food was good for that sort of thing. And so I really appreciated it. And y'all did a wonderful job. I know that was very hard. It was a huge conference. I had no idea going into it it was going to be that big. So kudos to all of you. And I think doing 3 in 1 year would be crazy. So I moving that thing off won't hurt anybody's feelings. I'm just sorry we have to go to Louisville next year. But it's going to be hard to top what y'all did. So really appreciate it. That's a lot of work. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, we're adjourned and we'll be back there in the new year. Thank God. This is about over.
I know.
January 19th.
All right. Thank you.
I'm going to go to the next one.